One thing I did do with value adding, I'd always give my stuff a different name. So if it was a rolled lamb loin with something, it'd be called a Parisian lamb roast. If it was a shoulder of lamb with whatever, we'd call it a Moroccan lamb roast. We'd never actually say what it was so that they could go around to the butcher around the road and say, oh, he does a shoulder of lamb with this Moroccan spice or whatever.
This is the Australian Butchers Guild Podcast, brought to you by Meat and Livestock Australia, the podcast for passionate butchers.
G'day and welcome to the Australian Butchers Guild Podcast. I'm your host, Doug Piper. Today I'm catching up with a butcher turned farmer, Alan Walden. I first met Alan in his butcher shop about 20 years ago, and it's located in the leafy North Shore suburb of Turramurra. Alan's business was always a must to visit when I was in the area. I used to love going into that shop. There was always something different he was trying out. His range of products, whether it be cheeses, seafood, different beef lines, something different that he brought in from the farm, like a goat, where we didn't really sell a lot of goats in the butcher shop then. But Alan was always willing to try something different just to keep his customers interested and inspire them and keep them coming back. A few years ago, Alan sold his business. He's been keeping himself busy growing prize-winning cattle and learning about how the different types of feed affect the quality of beef that he's growing. So we're going to cut on over there to Alan right now. Welcome, Alan.
Thanks, Doug. How are you?
Going well, mate. Thanks. How about yourself?
Fantastic. Never been better.
Living life as you should, mate. Out of the butcher shop and enjoying it.
Oh, yeah, living the dream. But the butcher shop was good. That was actually a pretty good life. I did enjoy that.
Yeah, true. It is a good life in the shop. So where are you today, mate?
Barrington, which is under the Barrington Mountains and just a few k's west of Gloucester, New South Wales.
It's a cold but lovely part of the world.
Can get a little bit cool here. Not as cold as the other side of the mountains, but we have got a good frost this morning.
Yeah, yeah. I remember going into your shop around about 20 years ago when I was selling sausage casings for Belrose Casings. And I think that was the first time I met you. And I remember going to that shop. I thought, wow, this is a really nice shop. It's a great shop to go into. How long have you been out of the shop for now?
I've been out of the shop for 6 or 7 years. I was in that shop for 20 years and it was a great shop. It was a really good shop. Good shop to work in, really good clientele. Really enjoyable to go to work every day.
It's a great part of the world down there, the old northern suburbs, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. You've got very good clientele there. And it wasn't far from where I lived, and that makes a big difference too. And very much like a village atmosphere there. It was really like a country, small country town in a big city. It was really nice.
Was it an existing shop, or did you start the shop up from scratch?
No, an existing shop. And originally, I believe it was opened by Lanes in the late 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
And had numerous owners over the years. And when I brought it, it was pretty close to being closed down. It was really battling, serving only 40 customers on a Saturday when I brought it.
Wow. For those that don't know the area, Turramurra, it's a strip shop, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a strip shop and it's got good parking. That's the big plus with it. You can park there. And all families, like families with kids at private school, it's a good area to have a butcher shop.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. A lot of private schools in that area. And I think a lot of the people are very loyal too. If you're looking after them, they'll certainly support you, don't they?
If you do it right, you've got them for a long time. If you do it wrong, they'll let everybody know. So you've just got to make sure quality and service. That's just the two things you've got to have.
So what was the thing for the butchers of today? There's a lot of guys out there doing really well, but there's probably, if not more, a lot of guys really struggling, and they might be doing that 40, 50 customers on a Saturday or any day of the week. How did you turn that shop around, mate?
I probably do it a lot different to a lot of blokes, and I think everyone has to do it different to somebody else. You have to have your own point of difference, and we tried to make that into a destination shop, which I think we did in the end. The main thing was quality, like good quality. We still boned all our own beef and still did to the day we sold the shop. I only brought as much carton meat as we had to, and all the rest was boned beef. And just look after the customers. The customers, look after them. One policy I had in the shop with my staff was, I always want a customer to leave happier than when they arrive. And it was just do whatever they want. Just look after them. Give them the right thing and look after them, because you don't have a business without a customer.
That's dead right there. It's always important to make sure they leave happy, you know, with what they wanted, or if not more. Because, you know, you give them a little bit of cooking knowledge, that's more. And it gives them the confidence to go away and create a great deal for the family.
Look, the other thing I did The shop was run down when I brought it. The machinery was run down. I invested as much money as I could afford back into infrastructure of the shop. And that would be cabinets, machinery, you know, painting, lighting, whatever. But I did that for 20 years. I actually worked it out at one stage and it averaged out at about $800 a week what we'd put back into infrastructure into that shop over a long period of time. But it was constantly upgrading and putting money back into your business, because without the business, you're not going to have money to feed yourself.
You've got to invest in your business. You can't just sort of let it fade away. You've got to keep making it, keeping it up to scratch. It's the same with, like, it's a bit like hygiene, isn't it? Once you get behind on cleaning things, it's harder to get it back. And it's the same with the whole look and feel of your shop. You know, the worse condition you let it get into, the more it's going to cost you to bring it back to scratch again.
And the more it's noticed by people when you don't do something, or when you do something, people notice the changes, or they notice the fact that it's dirty if you haven't done something.
Definitely. One of the things I loved going into your shop and talking with you is hearing how you always were doing something different. I'm trying this, Doug. I'm doing that, Doug. I'm not, you know, there was always something different that you were doing. I suppose it's success and growing your business is what drives you to do it. But what were some of the things that you found really important and successful for you that you tried?
I'm a great believer in, if you try something and fail, that's okay. But if you don't try anything, you're never going to make any change. One of the things we did in the early days, it was back in 2006, and you know yourself, Tarramurra, North Shore, there's a lot of dogs. We were boning beef and there was blokes around charging $3, $4, $5 for dog bones. So I'd recently done a trip overseas to Nepal and I just started this little charity that we gold coin donation for dog bones. Little did I know at the stage, and that charity grew for 10 years, and that charity is actually still going, but it grew for 10 years and I think we made $139,000 out of dog bones in a 10-year period that I gave away. But people would come to us because of the charity, because of we weren't charging them $5 for bones. It was just put your money in the bucket. And I would then write a newsletter once every 3 or 4 months and just give people information, not just on the charity, on the farms, on the meat, on product, very rarely on prices. I just always about the product, what we're doing, that sort of thing. Make it interesting. There was always a story. You had to have a story for everything. And I think as time's gone on, the story is just as important as the product or the price. And I know now with the younger generation, you rarely see people pick up a range of caged eggs for $3. They'll pay $7 for free range. And it's the story. People love a story. And Australia took a long time to get to that stage, I think.
It's a very important part of selling something, isn't it? Is having that story behind it, having that knowledge, having something there that you can tell a customer about what they're buying. Or what you're doing too.
What I've noticed with butchers, and it's fruit shops, and it's a lot of people that are resellers, they don't actually understand, or they don't have the knowledge to understand the processes of that food before it got on the plate at mum and dad's dinner on a barbecue on Sunday or whatever. And that was what I wanted to do, was understand. I love food processes, whether it's growing a cow or growing a carrot. I like the process of food or making cheese. And I think that's really important. And you see that a lot with wine. People hold up a bottle of wine and say, oh, this comes from Margaret River, or comes from the Hunter, or comes from Mudgee. They never say that with their beef, or they didn't in them days. And it's just putting the story so people understand it. And we were lucky enough in about 15 years ago, we went to France for a holiday, and it was just based around food. And I learned so much from that trip about food processes and what to try and pass on to people, which I thought was fantastic.
It gives you a lot of security, doesn't it, knowing the person that's selling you that product knows all about it. You know, we did a trip to France a few years back with the Butchers Guild when we had the World Butcher Challenge on, and it was just incredible to see and listen to the people talk about food. I'm very passionate about food, a bit like yourself, but it was just so reassuring and made you want to try something if they were talking about it. You know, you had to buy it, you had to try it pretty much. We went to this place, I don't know where it was in France, obviously, but this guy had all these different pâtés and slices and that. And the guy we were with, one of our managers was there, and he says, "Give me one of everything." And the guy threw his hands up in the air and he goes, "I'm not going to give you everything." He says, no, give me, I want to buy. You know, the way that he said it was wrong. This guy's absolutely gone, oh, shit, these guys want to take me, you know, try everything in the shop for nothing. They just want a free feed. But this bloke then saw the funny side of it, and he realized that he was wrong, and he gave us all this food. We paid for it, but it was just hearing that story behind it all and how it was processed and what, where the walnuts came from or where the macadamias came from, or he had so much knowledge there.
Yeah, we were the same. We went to a little restaurant in Provence and it was in a backyard basically with about 20 people, and this couple we knew over there took us. And I just said to him, I didn't speak any French or very little, and I said to the guy, just order anything in meat for the main, I'll eat anything. And he ordered me the lamb dish, and it came out and there was some shortbreads and kidney and chops and everything on the plate. And at the end of it, the chef himself, not anybody else, the chef himself came out and explained everybody's meal to every person. And it wasn't the best meal I've ever had, but it was certainly the best food experience I've ever had to this day. And they knew where the tomatoes came from, who grow them, the wine, the valley, the lamb. Everything had a story. And I'm like, how important is this? And it just, you left there and you were actually on a high about the story apart from the meal. It was fantastic. And I still remember it. And that was years ago.
I remember my shop, I got most of my beef out of Mudgee, and the customers all knew where it came from. For whatever reason, it was very important to my, and my shop was in Artarmon. And it was very important for them to know where, for a lot of them, where my meat came from. I found out it was Mudgee. It was grass-fed beef. It was basically Angus cross. And they were 200-kilo bodies, and they loved that. So when they'd have people were doing a lot of entertaining in the 90s, late 90s or mid-90s, and therefore when the people would come around to their house for a meal, they could tell them the story. They'd relay that message on. Where did you get your meat from? I got it from Artarmon Quality Meats down there, Doug the Butcher. Oh, yeah, what sort of beef is this? It tastes completely different to where I got my meat from. But it probably didn't taste any better. They're probably going to a little butcher shop where they were getting good quality meat. But they were able to actually align everything up. They could say, wow, this came from Mudgee. That's beautiful beef from Mudgee. You know, it's that whole thing really made them feel it was security, I suppose. And today it's very important, especially what we've been through over the last couple of years.
Yeah, look, it's all changed. And look, I know after the trip to France, I probably fell into it a little bit, but I started to stock some really good French cheeses. And we were the only supplier of that sort of cheese at that end of the North Shore. And then we went in like the pâtés. And I thought the whole thing is you go to somebody's place for a barbecue and the first thing they'll do is put out a cheese platter with the wine. So I thought, why don't we sell the cheese? Otherwise they're going to walk into IGA and buy it and they might buy the meat. So we started to stock that, but we knew the product. You've got to know the product. And once a month I'd have the girl out in front of the shop on a Saturday, the French girl from the cheese producers, and that was part of the deal. She'd get out there and sell the cheeses. And we moved on to smoked fish and things that were just easy to handle, but again, quality products where you knew the people. We went down to Tasmania. We'd seen where they got the smoked ocean trout from. We knew the whole product, the whole systems of everything. And I think that made a huge difference. It was another thing that I did was constantly, and this would be 3 or 4 days a week, would do tastings of something in the shop. It might be pâtés, it might be butter chicken, it might be whatever, but do tastings. And on a Saturday, for years, every Saturday we had a barbecue out the front of the shop. And I reckon that's the cheapest advertising you ever get. Let people try it. And one thing I said is don't ever, ever ask the customer if they want to buy it. Let them try it. They mightn't buy it for 6 months, but they might come in at Christmas and spend $300 on extra stuff.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Tastings always help. It helps the big players, like the big retailers. You see them still. Well, they're now doing it again in store there. You see them there with their curries and sauces and whatnot, but it's equally as important for a butcher to do it too, that, like, you know, whether it be sausages or meatballs or cheeses, even not your core business, but just cheeses that gets, like you said, it gets them in. Where did I get that? Where did I taste that nice cheese from? I remember that was at Allen's. I'll go down there, and next thing you know, bang, you won them.
Well, I tell them a triple cream brie, and I can tell you get to know the product. It was 67% fat. You'd have a Tarwin Blue, which come out of Victoria. We'd have a buffalo product, you know, but you had to know your product. It was no use having the same thing that Woolworths has got because they'll always beat you on price. Don't worry about what the guy down the road's got. You do what you do. And I had Jason around the corner, really good butcher, done really good hams, different to what I'd done, but ran a good business. We done something different. And it's being an individual. Don't be one of the sheep. Be an individual and do something different and do it properly.
And you don't have to be in the Tarramurra or the Woollahra or those more affluential areas. You know, you can be in the western suburbs or inner city or whatever. Just give them something different. Work on it a different way. Work on a different product. Work out what your customers are buying.
The thing you have to do with all of that is know your demographics and meet your market. And what worked in our shop probably wouldn't have worked in the Western suburbs, but what worked in the Western suburbs probably wouldn't have worked in our shop. So you need to be able to meet your market and sell to the people that you have and keep them loyal and keep them happy and keep them, keep them invited. And it's like that friendship, and you would have got that with your shop. You know the customers by name, you know their kids. And I was always look to the guys, never try to pressure sell anybody. If they wanted, and we'd have people buy fillet steak for their cat, never tell them they're stupid or whatever. If that's what they want, that's what you give them.
That's it.
Just little things. If they buy chuck steak or lamb spry, always ask would they like it diced up, slice the lamb spry, whatever. It's not hard. And it's a service industry. That's what we're paid to do. We're a service industry.
It's important, and body language too. So, even if, say, it is a lamb spry and they ask you to slice it, don't roll your eyes. It's a pleasure to do it because these people are paying you wages. These people are keeping your doors open. These people are helping you employ other people to make your life better. It's a service industry.
You would have seen yourself, you'd have a butcher and he'd have a whinge about Mrs. Jones when she left. It was a pain in the ass. At the end of the night, I'd pull the money out and I'd put the $20 across the counter. And I'd say, just tell me which one Mrs. Jones gave you that was a pain, because they all look the same to me.
Very true.
The money's all the same. It doesn't matter how who you get it off. It all pays the bills. It pays the wages. It pays the electricity. You've got to have that money in the till before you can open the door.
Oh, definitely. Products that you used to sell in your shop, did you do much value adding back then? I know it's been a few years, but you did so many different things there, and you from seafood to cheeses and all your condiments that you did. But in the shop window, value adding, did you have anything there that was that people really liked, that you sold a lot of?
We did a fair bit of value adding. Originally, before it was when it was the National Meat Association, for years we won the best. You'd have the side of lamb that you'd do and what you could do with it. We won that 3 or 4 years in a row. One thing I did do with value adding was I'd always give my stuff a different name. So if it was a rolled lamb loin with something, it'd be called a Parisian lamb roast. If it was a shoulder of lamb with whatever, we'd call it a Moroccan lamb roast. We'd never actually say what it was, so that they could go around to the butcher around the road and say, oh, he does a shoulder of lamb with this Moroccan spice or whatever. We'd give everything a different name. And I think that was a bit of a winner. We'd done 16 different types of sausages pretty consistently. We did a fair bit, not probably a little bit before the pastry days. We did a little bit with pastry, but it probably wasn't big by then. But again, we're talking about serving mostly families. My shop I had at Fairlight previously was more of them couples, which I think that pastry stuff probably would have went better because it was more of that single sort of meal. So, yeah, we did a fair bit of stuff different, and it was interesting. That was the main thing.
The whole demographics thing that you mentioned before is just so crucial too. Like you mentioned, Fairlight was a couples area. Tarramurra is a family orientated area. So being able to identify who's in your area and then having the right products there, like your value add, we bang on about value add all the time on the show here on the podcast. It's just so important. It's really what saved a lot of butcher shops over the years. I don't know if you remember, we used to do the counterattack program around Australia with all the program managers that worked for MLA, and we'd have little workshops around the place. And I remember one in particular we had down at Wollongong TAFE there, and a guy had ridden his motorbike 4 or 5 hours in the rain to come to this workshop that we were holding, and he was from Crookwell. His name was Graham Gibbs. He's still in business today.
Graham Gibbs was my apprentice at Mudgee years and years ago. I still talk to him every week.
Ah, fair dinkum.
And a lot of the products he was having there were some of the products out of our shop. He'd come up and spend a bit of time with me in the shop. Great guy.
I remember him coming in and he was saying he was at a loss. There was another butcher shop in town. He wasn't far from Goulburn. There was a lot of negative there. Like he didn't know which way to go, whether to just concentrate on doing something different like value adding or continue on his merry way trying to do wholesale and that. But he chose to go value add, and obviously going to see you, he came to the workshop. It turned his whole business around. I remember him going from being, he was always a happy guy, but he wasn't overly happy. But I know when I went and saw him after the workshop, and one of the butchers that was there, he actually went and gave him a hand of just setting up his window a little bit differently and showed him some things that he was actually doing in his shop as well. And it turned Graham's business around.
Yeah, and he's still there.
Yeah.
I spoke to him this week. He's still there.
And he's loving life. He's doing a great job there. He's always advertising on socials. It's a tiny little town, Crookwell, but he does so well, and there's people in Goulburn now come to see him.
Yeah, I think, look, the other thing that we did as time went on, again with my food processors, I actually ended up buying a farm and growing our own cattle and then another farm. And I know not every guy can do that, and there's probably a lot that can't, but that helped us a lot with the story as well. And one thing I did after that, it was again after my trip to France, I actually wrote a little news, like 8-page newspaper, and got it printed and give that to people. And it was just little stuff like that, and it just really got people engaged, I think. And we had customers turn up at the farm out at Dunny Dirt. We had 2 or 3 customers turn up out there, and that was really interesting. One of them was Chris Barth off the TV. She turned up there and done a radio program from the farm. So it was a whole lot of interesting things that transpired just from trying to say, I've always been a bit different, and I'm always like, do what you want to do and do it well. Don't do what Joe down the road does and try and copy him, because you're just a recipe to disaster.
Hey, mate, getting back to your sausages and everything, what made your snags better? Were you doing anything special? Do you have any tips for the butchers out there that might be struggling to make a better snag?
Again, it comes back to demographics. We were in a fairly mild area, so it takes out, you know, your spicy sausages were probably one of our very smallest sellers. So we had big kids area. We did mild snags like chicken and camembert. But again, when I done chicken and camembert, it was all Maryland fillets or thigh fillets. Saying that, we're in a good area, we're getting good money, you could afford to put that into them and get your money for it. 2 things I didn't do. I never used artificial skins, and some people think I'm crazy. I was always natural skins and always extra lean. We were probably about 85 or 90% CL for our snags. Always lean, keep the fat out of them, and do a good product. Again, I say it comes back to demographics and price, but that's what we did, just quality products. And no meat that's delo, like keep everything fresh, you know, no rubbish in them, no gristle. Just little quality things between every batch through the mincer, clean the plates out, get the plates on your mincer sharpened every 2 weeks. Or 3 weeks, just the little detail things. That was what we worked on, just detail.
Yeah, that's a good point, the plates on your mincer. I was terrible at it, mate. I'd wait until they just about munched out of the mincer before it came out pasty, until I'd change the blades on the cutters anyway. And maybe once a year I used to get the plates sharpened, if that. But yeah, it's a good point, because it does make a big difference. I always remember when you got a new mincer, or you got a new, when you got the plate done, the meat looked so much better that was coming out of it.
What I've said to blokes is, you grab a tray of your best mince, and if it's $20 a kilo, put it on the scales. We were making 7 of them on a Monday. You put that on the scales, and one of them's, you know, 5 kilos at $20, $100. A plate was $120, right? You're making so much stuff. We'd make sure we'd change the knives every, I think the knives were every week or every fortnight, and the plates were about once a month. We'd get them sharpened. I'd always have 3 sets of plates, and there'd always be half a dozen knives hanging up. And that there, when you look at, you know, just a tray, a mince almost pays for a plate. It's not a lot of money, and it's quite often it's the things we overlook. The other thing I used to be paranoid about was lights in the shop. I'd always make sure the shop was really brightly lit, even with spotlights in the roof, little LED spotlights that would shine into the cabinets as well. So I would highlight an area in a cabinet, not the cabinets we in front of us, the cabinets behind the customers on the back wall, the self-serve cabinets. And I'd have spotlights into them. So when people turned around, it was always illuminated, because the first thing people eat with is your eyes. Other little things, and not everyone's on the same page with me here, we had cabinets, self-serve cabinets with no doors on them. I think people are always, sometimes not as often, will open a door up to look at a product, where if they can reach in and grab it, they'll look at it, probably put it back, but they'll look at it and see what it is. I know you use more electricity, it costs more money to run them, but that was the way we operated.
Doors are a barrier, and it's something else you've got to clean. You know, you've got a handle there, you've got the glass here. Kids put their faces up against them, they've got, you know, sticky hands all over them. So, yeah, it's something that's, you've got to either be on top of it, but they are a barrier. We know that. You know, you look at the supermarkets they've all trialed at one stage or another. They've trialed a refrigerated product behind doors, like meat in particular, and yeah, they struggle to get people to open the doors. They just look at it. They go, no, can we bother? I'll just go keep going. Hopefully they go down the butcher shop down the road.
The other thing I did every night, and it drove the guys mad, but the way I think I'm mad anyway, but I'd have a big trolley. Every tray in the window would come out every night. Cabinets would be turned off. Air conditioner ran 24 hours a day, never got turned off. And every tray would get repacked in the morning, and all on that I don't know what they call it, that black paper that keeps the colour in it. The mint never got out the second day, never went through. If there was mints over, it went straight into the snags. It never got recycled. Again, it was little quality things. And I always look at the thing, when you look at business, the first loss is your cheapest loss. You can put a heap of that velo stuff into snags, and then your snags don't keep, and then you've got 50 kilos that's going off. We always just had it, the first loss is the cheapest loss. And I used to say to somebody, if you don't want somebody to sell that first cut of rump to your mother for $40 a kilo, don't sell it to someone else's mother. Trim it up, give them quality. So we get 20 bucks a kilo for our mints. Don't sell something to somebody you wouldn't sell to your mother.
100% agree with there. You see that a lot. And that's one thing the retailers don't have any control over either. How many times, you know, you walk into the supermarket to do your weekly shop, and then you walk through their meat. I always walk through the meat case, and I look at the steaks, I look at the cutting standards, and you see that first cut of rump there. I think that's good for the butcher, because hopefully someone will pick that up. They'll buy it there. That's just garbage. I'm not going back there again. I'll go back to the butcher. You know, I always get what I want there.
Yeah, and that's the one thing. Supermarkets will never beat a quality butcher on quality and service. You look at the big supermarkets. They've gone to having a butcher in there, got rid of them, brought them back again 10 years later, got rid of them again. Like, they can't do it like you'll do it in your own business. You'll never beat them on price. You just got to beat them on quality and service.
So today you're up at Barrington Toss. So what are you doing up there? You mentioned something about growing cattle when you had the shop in Tarramurra. So you followed your passion. You got out of the shop and you're out there doing what you really love doing.
What happened with the shop was everyone says, oh, you sold the shop and you got out. You were lucky. I probably was lucky, but I never had the shop for sale. I tell everybody that. I had someone drove me mad to buy it, and I did sell it. At the stage, I'd had two farms. I had one at Blaney and one at Mendoran, and we had about, I don't know, 1,200 acres, probably running 100 breeding cows, which means we were running up to 200 head of cattle and probably 500 sheep and for a while goats as well. I've sold all of that. I sold the business. I've sold the two farms, and I brought 140 acres up here on the river. We're running just about 30 cows. That's a bit of a hobby, really. And as I think I told you the other day, I had a bit of success in the Wingham Beef Week with grass-fed beef here the other day, which was pretty handy.
So if you had the butcher shop still, you'd probably obviously, well, look, you were putting beef through your shop, but having the knowledge that you've got now, the story would be the same. You'd still be pushing, it's a grass-fed product off my own property. The different types of grasses, does that make any difference to the structure, the muscle in the cow?
I think it makes difference to the protein intake the cattle have. Now, it's the same with your kids or anything. Anything that's going to grow needs protein. So you need to have grasses that will sustain that protein. And look, I could talk this to you for hours, but I'll keep it really simple. We would have a lot of paddocks and rotate our stock so they always had fresh food ahead of them. Never overstock, always tend to be understocked. But yeah, I did grow a lot of different types of grass species and improve it. And I think it's just a lot of it's common sense, Doug. It's not rocket science. You don't have to go to university. I used to sit down, and people think I'm stupid. I'd sit down and watch what my sheep ate. And I've watched sheep eat, and I see them eat seven different types of grass, but in rotation. They'd eat it, and then they'd come back and eat it again. Like, they'd go clover, lucerne, skeleton weed. And some of the weeds, and people don't get this, some of the weeds are actually beneficial because, you know, Patterson's curse, if you got a tiny little bit, gives them a source of magnesium. Without magnesium, you don't have muscle strength. So it can get really technical, but it doesn't have to. It's just common sense, look after them and know your product. When this got to the butcher shop, we'd always tell people, but we'd have a slideshow on the TV, never of dead animals, but you'd have some nice pretty pictures of the farm and in the grass and lovely pastures, and people like that sort of stuff. You're not going to have a number on them and say number 8 in the cool room now. The feel-good stuff, what I say, just the feel-good stuff. So
yeah, the warm fuzzy.
Yeah, the warm fuzzy. People love to see, you know, nice green grass and maybe a few, you know, flowers in the paddock or whatever, and fat cattle or lambs playing. You know, it just makes them feel good that, like I say to people with my animals, they have a very good life and one bad day. That's what happens with them. They have a good life and there's one bad day.
That's it.
And if we don't eat animals, if we don't eat beef cattle, or if we don't eat meat sheep, they will become extinct.
They will. And also, we spoke about this the other day. You're not actually cattle farmers or sheep farmers or goat farmers. You're actually grass farmers, aren't you?
Firstly, a grass farmer. Secondly, a dinner farmer. And I say to people, and I talk to them now, and they say, what did you do for a living? And I said, look, I was very lucky. I've had a love of animals since I was a kid, and I worked with them for 42 years every day in a butcher shop. I'm a lucky man. It's good. It's a process. And so long as you have that animal rights thing and you look after your animals and they have a good life, and look, with my wife, if the animals aren't having a good life, either am I. So you look after your animals, and at the end of the day, you eat them. And, you know, there's nothing better than raising your own animals. And then we had lamb cutlets last night here that I'd processed myself down in the shed down here and hung them in a mate's cool room, and they were absolutely beautiful. You know, it's just about the processes and growing a good product, whether it be a carrot, a pumpkin, or, you know, sirloin steak. It's still our food at the end of the day, and we're at the top of the food chain.
Yeah. See, this is important too for smaller butcher shops as well, like getting to know a farmer or a local farmer from somewhere and using that as a strength to market their own business. So by obviously, say, someone kind of contact you over the next couple of weeks maybe, and they might say, turn around and say, oh, I'd love to put some of your beef in my shop. So, you know, can I come out and meet you? And obviously the farmer or Alan's going to turn around and say, hopefully, yeah, sure, come out. I'd love to talk to you. I'd love to show you what I'm doing. And this all in turn is the butcher learning more about the product that he's selling, and that relationship between the farmer and the butcher. And that's the romance of it all, isn't it? That's what gets it over the line with the customers. Like, I go out there on a Saturday and I buy my beef. I look at the cattle on his property. I want that one, that one, that one. And next week, you know, I've got them in the shop and here we are. It's just a really great part of the industry that you can get involved in and to help you progress and to succeed.
Look, there's one thing I learned in life a long time ago, and someone told me, and it doesn't matter what part of the food chain you're at or what part of business or where you are, if you listen more than you talk, you always learn a lot. You listen to what people say. You don't have to take it all on board, but listen, and it's amazing how much you'll pick up. And the other thing I've noticed with butchers, and this is a thing that I've just noticed with a lot of guys that I still know really well, is we all get older, and we said this at the start of the conversation, how quickly all this winds around. I don't think enough guys ever think of an exit plan. Like, they never think they're going to get to 65 or whatever. And there's another butcher I know, great old guy, he's nearly 80, still in his shop, and you know him. He's a brilliant old guy, and he loves what he does. But I don't think a lot of guys put enough into that exit plan, what they're going to do when I retire. You know, and I think that's also an important part, is put that money away into your super, pull your tax down, all that sort of stuff. And I don't think that happens enough either.
Yeah, it's a problem that we've got when, especially guys like myself, superannuation wasn't compulsory when we first started working. You've got to load up where you can to try and make sure you've got that exit plan covered. You know, we all want to have, maybe have that caravan behind the car and go do a bit of grey nomading around Australia or head off overseas and see a little bit of the world while you're able to. If you don't do it, no one else is going to do it for you.
No, and the other thing is, quite often, if your mincer breaks down, you'll call someone to fix it, or your bandsaw, the bearing goes, call someone to fix it. But blokes don't get someone to work out how they're going to invest out of their shop, or how they're going to work their super, or how they're going to do whatever. And from what I've noticed from butchers over the years, there's a fantastic number of great guys, but I would say not a lot of them are super switched on with that side of the financial side of it. And I think quite often they're afraid to get outside help with that as well.
You can't afford not to do it. Well, mate, look, it's been absolutely fantastic to catch up with you. Really good to see you again and listen to what you've been up to. And congratulations for all the hard work that you've done over the years, and it's showing in what you're putting out there, what you're winning with your cattle.
You know what it's like. You get out of the shop, you can't walk past a cabinet in a supermarket or a butcher shop, and you're on holidays and you pull into a country town and, you know, you go to the shopping centre and you're looking in the window of the butcher shop. I just think it's in your blood, and it's, you know, you still seem to have the passion for it. I had the passion. We know, you talk to Mark Edwards. I'm a mate of Mark Edwards. He's got the passion. There's guys out there that have the passion that love it. And I think that's the main thing with any job you have. I used to say to my blokes, if you can't come to work and whistle, you're probably in the wrong job. And at one stage of my life, I had to put off a good mate because he just hated what he was doing, you know, and that reflected on the other guys. I said, you know, come to work and whistle and enjoy it, and it's a lot easier than coming to work and grumbling and saying how hard it is, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
We are in a great industry. People have to eat every day no matter what the economy is.
Yes, we do need to eat, and that's why we're in a pretty safe sort of position, really. As long as people have to eat, they don't have to take a pill, we'll be right.
Yeah, I think we're okay with that.
All right then, mate. Well, you take care of yourself, and we'll catch up with you soon.
Thanks very much, Doug.
No worries, Alan. Thanks, mate.